accession number 27060, Reel 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Bill Stacey in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 20th of the 5th, 2004, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Bill, you were talking about being on Crete, and you spoke a little bit about what you recall of the paratroopers coming in, but before we talk in depth about that particular instance, can we talk about the sort of preparation a bit more in relation to what you presumed would be imminent attack?
You know, first of all, what confronted us when we landed and we got in underneath the olive trees was the fact that you couldn't put your foot down for excreta everywhere.
You were mentioning that. You were told to camouflage yourselves. What did you have to camouflage yourselves with?
Well, is that still on?
You were mentioning that you were short of ammunition, you were short of equipment, you were told, presumably, to take cover.
Yeah.
And you're mentioning under the olive groves. Did you have any other equipment that you could use to...
We didn't have any equipment at all to camouflage ourselves, other than some netting and bunting that they'd picked up from down the dock area, I think they got it from, and apparently that with the lessons they learnt in Greece about camouflage, they've done a very good job, because it was a very rare occasion that the spotter planes picked us up, and they should have, because they used to come down so close to us. You know, you could actually see the pilot in the cabin with his binoculars having a look around, and yet he hardly ever picked up a target at all. So what it, you know, with the bunting and the netting, it must have been very effective, although we didn't think about that too much at that time, you know. That, in retrospect, it must have been the reason why we weren't so closely attacked. Yeah. But in the preparation for... We had a major burst, and he was of German origin, and he decided that the best thing a soldier can be if he's going to fight is fit, and did he make us fit? He marched us at the double all around Crete, up hills and down dales, and I can tell you, within a fortnight or 3 weeks, even though we were reasonable before we went to Greece, we were super fit when the time came, when the action started, you know. And of course, food stuff was very hard to get. The people in the villages were extremely good. They gave us what they could, but it was bully beef and biscuits, and that was about it, you know. And they used to come around with eggs and that sort of thing, and we'd buy them off them or swap them with something. But we survived pretty well, actually. Germans start to come in person.
Well, we'll talk about that too. Bill was talking about the locals and how they helped.
Yeah, oh, marvellous. I can remember the first... We camped... I'm a bit lost for names of villages, but we camped beside a stream, and if you looked up on the right-hand side, there was a big mountain that was snow-capped. Anyhow, as soon as we got on this down beside this stream, everybody stripped off and clear crystal water until you got into it, and then it was a bit minus 10 degrees.
So you're mentioning this lake, the freezing water.
Yeah, well, this was a short stream from the mountains that went into the... I think the name of the place was Clevos, but I'm not sure about it. But anyway, it was short and sharp and straight into the Mediterranean Sea, and they all run down and dived. Nobody made the other side, although it was only 50 yards wide. Nobody made the other side. They're absolutely frozen to death, you know. But it was wonderful to get into this clear, cool water, and just to drink it was... when you looked up to your right-hand side, you could see the snow caps on the top of the hills, and it wouldn't have been more than 10 or 15 miles away, the water was snow, you know. As I said before, the fact that this major burst and put us on a hard, rigorous training schedule that saved a lot of lives, in my opinion, and continued to save lives after the boys got captured because they were fit, you know.
How would you have rated morale given your situation at this point? You're not particularly well prepared.
I would say, with the exceptions of the always the odd man out, that morale was marvellous. I personally never heard anybody say anything that would make me think that he was frightened or wanted to run away or anything. They were all ready and prepared for what they were sent there for, and as was right through my army career. I've never struck any. I've struck of people and myself that's been frightened, mostly frightened of being frightened. You know, that was the point. I can recall one fella, he hated machine guns, especially from aircraft, and he used to dive underneath a truck at his opportunity, but there was a snake running around, and it got under the sandbags. He just went over and put his hand in and pulled the snake out, you know, so there's different types of bravery. But he wasn't to the extent where he'd run away or surrender or anything. I don't think any of our fellows surrendered. They were just ordered to lay their arms down, what was left, you know.
People talk of being ordered, well, possibly not in your case, being ordered to fight to the last man. We hear Hitler's orders in Stalingrad, for instance.
Yeah.
Don't give up. Fight to the last man. Was that something that you and your comrades would be prepared to have
Well, done? It's my personal opinion that if we had been in that...
In relation to, we were talking about surrender, we were talking about fighting to the last man, you were going to tell us what you...
Well, it's my opinion that if the situation had have been that, and we'd have been given orders that there's no backing off, we would have done what we were told. I've got no doubt whatsoever that that's what would have happened, because everything that was asked of us, we done it without grumbling too, I can tell you. Of course, Australian soldiers always whinge like buggery, everybody knows that. And as our CO said, you don't want to worry while they're whinging, it's when they stop the trouble that comes, you know. But I really think, that to answer your question, that had that situation come to us, we'd have handled it just the same as anybody else. Although it's a dreadful situation, I don't believe in this. See, under the Geneva Conventions, nobody can call no quarter. You mean you must give people a chance to surrender. You can't just wipe them out because you want to, but still, in lots of cases during the war, that wasn't adhered to.
And in your position, you've mentioned that you were preparing yourself physically. What of mentally, though?
Well, I think it comes with the preparation. You prepare physically, you've in the back of your mind, you know that you're a soldier, you know that that's your job that you're going to do, and that you just say to yourself, well, if it comes to the worst, we're in it for keeps, you know. It all goes along with the same thing. If you're physically... But I think being physically fit does have, to a certain extent, an effect on your mental. If you're not fit and you're hurting and you're tired and you resolve sort of fades away a bit. It never happened to me or any of my mates, but I think it would.
People talk of you know, sort of shagging one another, sort of giving each other a bit of stick to keep people going.
Oh, yeah.
If there's any grumbling, you might sort of have a
They're always having a go at one another. I can remember we had had a sergeant and coming back. As soon as ever the truck stopped, he'd be out with a shovel, and he was the greatest and quickest trench digger that you ever seen in your life. You know, one of the larrikins in the unit called Doug James, Mucker James, they used to call him because he was a miner. And this fella jumped out and dug his hole, and he's crouched down his hole with his tin hat on, and and Mucker got a big handful of gravel and chucked it on his hat, and this fella jumped about 17 feet in the air, and Mucker thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened. It just frightened the bloody daylights out of him. Yeah. But it wasn't all tough stuff, you know. There was lots of times when everybody was happy and knew what they were doing. The biggest thing, I think, is when a unit's efficient, it's a happy unit. You know, it knows what its job is, it knows what it's got to do, and it does it. And if something happens, well, all they can say is that, well, we've done the best we could do under the circumstances. You know. As I mentioned before, in Crete, in my opinion, if the three regiments had been equipped with 25 pounders, the Germans wouldn't have landed a soul on the island. Definitely, you know. And really, whether they were saving them up for the push up the desert, but there were plenty of new 25 pounders available in Alexandria if they had wanted to send them instead of those old Italian, French 75s and that sort of thing.
What were your concerns at this time, if anything?
My main concern is that I think, like every other soldier, is that he's not maimed. It's bad enough getting killed. That's something, you're there, but to be maimed and for the rest of your life, I think that's one of the things that's in the back of everybody's mind. It was mine anyway. I always thought to myself, well, if I'm going to get hit, I hope it's properly, you know, not see fellas with their legs blown off or half their guts blown away. And not for me. I'd sort of put the cue in the rack straight away, you know. And then you see people are so brave, you know, that Some people die easy and some people die hard, and it's just a person's backbone, guts, it is. That's all it amounts to.
You're mentioning that earlier on and how it sort of is all related to chance and coping with the general situation of the individual.
Yeah, well, look at that. My special, the three of us, we were in the militia together before the war, was Gordon Tognetti and Tommy Winstanley and myself. Now, Gordon Tognetti got hit by aircraft. His mates on the gun that he was on put him in the slit trench and laid beside him on the outside, and the strafing come on and Gordon got hit in the bottom of the bloody trench and the others didn't get hit. Although, you know, that's fate, isn't it, you know? And I'll tell you a story. When I was up the desert, I picked up two Berettas and an old Italian 44. This thing was the biggest revolver you ever seen in your life. Used to only about a dozen bullets for it, and it used to fire bullets as big as your thumb, you know. Big 44 lead bullets. Anyway, I brought it back and I sold the two Berettas to a couple of officers on the Swedish Bratdal, and I brought the other one back and I gave it to Gordon Tognetti. Now, Gordon took the gun to Greece, and when he got wounded in Crete, the fellas that he was with took the revolver, because he was evacuated to a central clearance station, and they brought the gun right through the rest of the war back to Australia. And Gordon's brother was in the diplomatic corps, and Gordon gave him the revolver. And he went to New Guinea and blew his brains out with it. Now, if that's not fate, you know, that gun travelled, probably never fired a shot in anger in itself, and yet it came right back to Australia and went to New Guinea, and a fella committed suicide with it. Now, if I hadn't have got that gun, you know, the coincidence is absolutely amazing. I've always felt, not that I could do anything about it, but I always felt so sorry that I brought the thing home with me. Yeah, bloody shame.
In relation to people talking of the coming of the Germans, you were being strafed, you were being bombed closer to the time of the actual drop.
Yeah, well,
let's talk about that.
Well, like from, I'm just a gunner, you know, and from my point of view, I thought that the hierarchy made some very, very good assessments, because when the, of course, we were told that if they did come, they would try to occupy the higher ground and also see if they could get an aerodrome pretty smartly, you know. So when they did come, that's exactly what they went for, you know. And of course, our defences were already on the higher ground, and, you know, the, and which they nicknamed different names, like Hill 6 and Hill 1 or something, and the Vineyard, and so they were pretty well, I think the layout was, they were pretty well prepared for where the actual drops would go, and that's why I think that the Germans suffered such dreadful casualties, you know. It was just absolutely, they got slaughtered. And I remember reading a report, you know, they talk about the Germans, they were an elite regiment, but a report by one of the lieutenants said that when the so many were being killed, and when they hit the ground and he got a few together, he had trouble with his youngest paratroopers trying to get them to do what they were told, because they were that bloody frightened, you know, with the, all that was going on. And so, you know, everything doesn't always go the one way, does it? And the soldiers are soldiers. And of course, another thing too that people don't realise, that those paratroopers, most of those paratroopers, the only time they'd ever heard a shot fired was dummies when they were dropping in landing practice. You know, that's the first time they were ever engaged with the real stuff. So, and it must have been like coming down and watching your fellas ahead of you just hanging in the straps, and you've got to come through this maelstrom of fire, and that's what it was, because once the boys woke up that the doors were the things to aim at, they just concentrated on the doors of the aeroplanes, you know. Anything to come out had to come through it, so, you know, I think they were lucky that it was only the planes that were sort of out of the main phase of the thing that managed to land coordinated troops. And
well, let's talk about that occasion. On the 20th of May, the invasion of Crete begins. What do you recall of the initial realisation that that's what was going to happen, that was actually happening now?
Well, one of the things that I particularly remember was that, as a matter of fact, it was remarked on four or five times, things have gone bloody quiet, you know, there's no strafing, there's no, everything's quiet of what's going to happen. And then all of a sudden you could hear this like a bumblebee in the distance, and that got louder and louder and louder, and then we could see that they had these bloody bloody big things that Kingsford Smith used to fly, dozens and dozens of them all headed in the pattern, you know, and then they broke away and into groups and circled and come in and start dropping their. And they had it. They must have had people on the island that weren't civilians or something, because I remember one place there. There's a big dip in between these two big hills that's sheltered everything from going down onto the aerodrome, and they flew straight in and straight down there as if they'd been there 100 times. You know, it was already, they knew exactly where they were going, and if at that time that we had realised that was what we were going to do, it would have been the easiest thing in the world to set two groups up on either side of these hills, and you could have, they went past us, and you could see them sitting in their seats. You could have thrown a rock at the plane. Of course, we started firing, there's only one or two here and another two there, but there had been a concentration of troops along that alleyway. Three or four of them might have got through, but they would have all gone down, and then the rest of them wouldn't have been able to use the same funnel. But of course, we weren't to know that, and it didn't take that long either. You know, one minute everything was still and quiet, and the next minute it's all bloody hell let loose. And then, of course, the other plane, Stuka's trying to soften things up, and the fighter plane's blazing at everything that moved. It really was catastrophic, if as you'd call it.
Yeah. You mentioned, obviously, you know, the planes coming, hearing this bumblebee coming over the horizon.
Yeah.
What were you saying to one another at that time?
We were just going to say, where are they going to drop them? That's what we were thinking about, you know. What's their plan? Where are they going to drop them? And when the first lot went over us, and that they were headed for the aerodrome, and then it started again, and I thought, well, sooner or later, they're going to drop them here, you know. So they did, it wasn't one concentrated everything there, you know. They're working to a plan, obviously, but they didn't get to where they thought they would quick enough, and that's why they lost so many people, you know, and they couldn't set up a front that they could defend the people that were already there. But as I said before, the ammunition in these guns was useless. They were firing on a place they finished up calling the oil works, the olive oil works. The Germans were in there, and they could see the shells lobbing and no explosions. Mm. You know, just.
Where was your location at the time of the arrival?
We were at Souda Bay. Towards, I suppose, towards Retimo. Yeah.
People talk of Retimo and
Heraklion and.
That place had been secured. What of your situation? Can you describe to us, as a gunner, what your role was during the drop?
Well, I wasn't a member of a gun crew. Sort of backup infantry, because there was only, you know, a certain number of guns that the gun crews required for. They were just sort of one gun here, and it wasn't this. You had a regiment of guns. They just poked them around where they thought that they'd do the best job. But we took up positions as between. Souda Bay and Retimo, I suppose it would be. But we didn't actually encounter any of the actual drop of the paratroopers. It's when the ones that had landed start to get organised, that's when we struck them.
Yeah. Well, what did that in? Tell us about that.
Oh, well, as a matter of fact, it wasn't very great because. The infantry had knocked the most of them off, and you know they were more or less trying to regroup themselves and get some secure positions, I suppose you'd call it. And it was a sort of a stalemate at the finish.
So your position at this time and your initial experience of German troops.
As far as the German troops are concerned, as I said before, that they're very efficient, highly trained personnel, and they were doing what they were supposed to be doing too, you know, doing their best. But they had overwhelming odds, the Germans, I reckon, you know, initially. It's when they start to bring the other troops in by boat that, you know, that they got the better of the situation. But as far as the paratrooper was concerned, in my opinion, they were finished another couple of days, and that without the reinforcements for them from the sea, that it would have been all over.
Well, people talk of this invasion, this paratroop drop,
yeah.
Being like an attack, comparing it to sort of attack of two worlds, two planets almost.
Yeah.
Do you recall actually seeing any parachutes dropping?
Oh, yeah.
Describe to us what that was like. I mean, this is a first almost. Yeah. I mean, it happened in Greece, but...
Well, you know, the plane, had, and they flattened out the plane. They weren't very high off the ground either. And the first thing you see was somebody appear at the big door in the middle of the plane. And the next thing, this bundle had come out, and when we first saw it, we didn't know that they were actually paratroopers, because they dropped a lot of gear with the, as well as the men, you know. They dropped heaps of ammunition and machine guns, because the paratroopers, most of them were only equipped with the German standard rifle. The other stuff came in their supplies that was dropped, you know. There wasn't a submachine gun in every gun, every paratrooper's hand, you know. But, of course, they got plenty of supplies, and, of course, our fellas got some of them too, because when they woke up to the signal pattern, they laid the things out in the ground, and the supply planes used to come over and drop the gear to our fellas instead of the paratroopers, yeah. And the point is that once they start to come out, the first thing you know is it's like seeing a bomb come out of an aeroplane. When you first see it, you think, well, that's going to hit us right in the middle of the head, but it's different, you know. It takes time before the thing happens, and sometimes it'll be a mile away before the actual makes contact with the ground. And these paratroopers were more or less the same, you know. They didn't just drop straight out of the plane and onto the ground. They were spread out a bit. Not that they were in the air for very long, but I suppose to them it seemed hours. But to us it seemed no time at all, because before they were out of the hull, and either they'd be hanging in their what's name or trying to work their shrouds before they hit the ground. And you got to feel a bit sorry for them, you know, in a way.
People describe it as a turkey shoot. People describe it as, you know...
Before they got to the ground, and of course, another thing too, a lot of them were injured when they hit the ground too, you know. They had their ordinary number of casualties with broken legs and arms and all that sort of thing. But when they first come out of the plane, when they start to wake up, the infantry start to wake up, that the idea was to concentrate on the doors. It was a turkey shoot, you know. There was more dangling on parachute lines than there was struggling to work their parachutes. It just killed hundreds of them. Yeah. And, of course, the most vulnerable time for them is when they hit the ground. Well, they're trying to get their senses together and get organised into their platoons and that sort of thing. That's when they dropped them right in where the concentration of our infantry was, and of course they got cleaned up pretty smartly. And it made you feel a bit sorry, but
what were you doing at this time?
Yeah, well, we were in the second line. We were covering the infantry that were in the front line, and we didn't have a great deal of contact with it. We fired shots, and I got shot at, and naturally, but I didn't get hit. I don't know whether I hit anybody either, but...
Well, people talk about that, and they're never quite sure. And they're sort of asked by a grandchild, did you ever kill anyone?
Yeah. Well, how do you, you know, you intend to if you can, but you don't, like from 200 or 300, 400 yards away, you don't really know, unless you occupy that area. Like when we were in Tobruk, we occupied the area that we shot on. Well, then we saw the people that we killed, you know, but in the case of Crete, you didn't, you just... You shot at them and hoped that you had success. Mm.